Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartzstrauber. On today's show, Cuba's digital future. As President Obama looks to normalize relations with Cuba and end a decades-long embargo, what are the challenges that lie ahead? How does Cuba get connected? How can Americans now take advantage of this new situation and make contact with relatives in Cuba and vice versa? Joining me to discuss this are several guests. I'll start by introducing them one at a time. Addie Bryant is the Chief of Staff at Engage Cuba. Addie, thanks for joining.
Thank you.
Michael Mizell, Director of External Affairs at Engage Cuba. Michael, thanks for joining.
Thank you.
And we also have Lydia Bayoud, Senior Tech and Telecom Reporter for Bloomberg BNA, who has been following the Cuba issue closely. Lydia, thanks for joining.
Thanks for having me.
So guys, let's start out by kind of setting the stage for what Cuba looks like now when it comes to technology, because while it is easier to travel there now, probably most Americans don't really have a clear concept of what life is like in Cuba when it comes to technology. But let's actually start by introducing the coalition. What is Engage Cuba? Addie, if you want to take a shot at that.
Yeah, sure. Engage Cuba is a nonprofit advocacy organization dedicated to lifting the trade and travel ban with Cuba, otherwise known as the embargo. Since President Obama and President Castro announced they were normalizing relations on December 17th, 2014, we identified that Congress was kind of the next step. Obama could make a lot of changes regulatorily through his administrative power, but ultimately, the embargo is kind of planted throughout U.S. code. And in order to have true freedom of trade and travel for Americans, Congress needs to act. And so what we've done is set up a coalition of a lot of different interests. And that's what makes our organization really unique. It's really clear cut. We have a mission of ending the trade and travel ban, and we're bringing in people from tourism, travel, the tech sector, from groceries, agriculture, everybody. We're bringing them all in into one coalition to say enough is enough. You know, too long this policy has been stuck in South Florida politics, and it's time for the rest of the United States to engage and the rest of American industry to say, you know, we want to trade with our island neighbors 90 miles off our coast.
Yeah, and it might be a popular misconception for Americans who've seen President Obama's announcement thinking that the embargo is over, everything's great, but the work is clearly not done. There's a lot more to do.
Right. And the next president, you know, maybe a President Trump, could come in and say, nope, not going to do it.
Right. And that's important, the fact that you might need Congress to make it more permanent. So what is life like for the daily for Cubans daily when it comes to technology? Lydia, you've looked at this issue. What is the state of technology today?
So across the island, most of what you have is a 2G connection. And that's for wireless devices. Now, in the home, less than 5% of Cuban homes have the internet available to them. The Cuban government actually has an ambitious project underway to get up to 50% of homes to be made internet accessible by 2020. That doesn't mean that 50% of homes will, you know, be able to afford, will be interested in connecting to the internet. But as my friends here from Engage Cuba can tell you, there is a lot of interest and a lot of desire for that connectivity across the island.
And just to put that in context, 2G, I mean, in the United States now, pretty much the whole nation is blanketed in 4G or 4G LTE. There are some challenges in rural areas. But what can you do with a 2G connection?
Not much. Let's see. 1G would have been the era of just making phone calls. 2G... enabled
like email,
email and text messaging. Yeah, the era of SMS that we all know and love. But, you know, 3G is when we started getting things like when you could put iTunes and music and different sort of apps on your phone. 4G, though, is what's really enabling video and all of this high bandwidth data that everyone is hungry for. And in the U.S. and across the world, a lot of people are looking at 5G. But right now, Cuba seems light years away from that. And in the home, they really only have dial-up speeds right now.
And what's really fascinating is that in the decades that the embargo has persisted, it's not like Cubans have been totally shut off from the rest of the world. They've been able to get information in really innovative ways, given the circumstances, living under an oppressive communist dictatorship. So how have Cubans been able to consume American popular culture for all this time with the embargo in place? Tell me about El Paquete.
So El Paquete is this really innovative and impressive network of USB drives that are distributed throughout the island that carry content. And it's almost like a subscription service. You can check off what shows or award ceremonies you want to watch that have been broadcast around the world, but mostly in the US, from your local Paquete dealer. And then he goes back and gets that content and delivers it to you. So an interesting anecdote, I was in Cuba recently with one of my colleagues, and we had this really impressive Cuban tour guide. And she spoke incredible English, and my colleague asked her how she learned English. And the tour guide responded, friends. And he said, my colleague said, well, your friends speak English? I'm confused. And she said, no. I learned English by watching the show Friends. So it just goes to show that, despite this political lack of connectivity that we've had between the two countries, there's still a lot of appreciation and exposure to American culture.
But El Paquete is offline, right? So it involves people actually traveling to the United States from Cuba with maybe a terabyte hard drive, putting a bunch of stuff on it that's offline, physically then taking it back to Cuba, disseminating it through offline drives. And is that what made it work, the fact that the government couldn't see what was going on because it was all offline? Or did they just turn a blind eye to this?
I think both, right? I mean, the truth is that what people were consuming was, and still is in large part, just cultural and entertainment. So I don't think the government really felt a threat by the distribution of this network. And I'm sure there are a lot of people that work for the government that are, subscribers to El Paquete themselves.
Well, and it was so successful and became such a widespread part of daily life in Cuba that the government actually set up their own version of their own Paquete to distribute, their either propaganda or other materials that they wanted the public to consume. And so, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. And I think the success of the Paquete is really underscored by the fact that the Cuban government felt compelled to have their own version.
Yeah, I guess even the Castro regime had to marvel at the entrepreneurial nature of his own citizens. So the Cuban government is not totally anti-internet. At least these days, there have been some measures that show that they're embracing the transition to digital future, however slow it may be, starting with 35 public Wi-Fi hotspots. So Lydia mentioned earlier that only 5% have internet in the home, but if we're talking about access to internet, just like the ability of someone to walk to a hotspot, we're looking at a much higher number of Cubans, right? Is something like 30% or?
Atexa, which is Cuba's sort of state-run telecom provider, has said that I believe I've seen figures varying between 100,000 and 200,000 people get online at these Wi-Fi hotspots every day.
And that's pretty impressive given the challenges, but this is very expensive, right? I mean, the average Cuban is living on $25 a month US, and it's $2 an hour to connect to the Wi-Fi. So is this a boon for just the upper class in Cuba? Have we not seen the benefits for lower income and middle income Cubans?
So the Cuban economy is actually really complicated, to put it mildly. Most Cubans, sure, if you're employed by the state, and sure, the vast majority are living on the state wage, which is about $25 a month. However, because of the cultural and, familial ties that Michael talked about earlier between Miami and Havana mostly, Miami money is flowing in at astounding rates to Cuba. And I'm sure Lydia can speak to this, but Western Union is a household name in Cuba. They signed a contract with the government. They're everywhere on the island now. They're in like 300 plus locations, and money is coming in to support entrepreneurship, to support restaurants, Airbnb, which I'm sure we're going to get to. And so the average Cuban, it's debatable if they're only living on $25 a day. Regardless, $2 an hour is super expensive. It isn't necessarily accessible, but there is, and Michael probably can talk about this, there's a little bit of like a black market internet system hooked up, and that's how a lot of people are also accessing it.
Can you describe the scene? Because it is a fascinating scene around these hotspots, right? I mean, it has changed the way that people live in the country, how they go about their daily lives. It's really, it's something to see. And just for our listeners, trying to paint a picture of what goes on at these hotspots.
So it's a physical gathering, right? So I was describing before we started taping that for a first-time visitor to Cuba, it can be astounding because you'll pull up on a street corner that happens to be one of these Wi-Fi hotspots, and you'll see a bunch of folks all looking at their phones. And also what we were commenting on before is that by nature of this being a hotspot and a public space, it becomes an almost communal experience. So it can actually be very emotional to see people FaceTiming with their relatives in the U.S. and showing, you know, that face to the other people next to them so that they can participate in the conversation.
I think what is jarring for a person who's never been to Cuba, you're driving down the street, you know, maybe you're in the back of like a 55 Chevy, and all of a sudden you turn to your right, you're at a stoplight, and there's just like a crowd of people all with their head downs in their phones, which in the United States, you know, people, you know, texting or surfing the internet on their phone, you know, while they're walking the streets, a normal sight. But to see everybody kind of like crowded together fighting for space on the sidewalk is not something you're normally going to see in the United States. And you look over and you're like, why are people doing that? And then that's what the kind of realization that Cuba is a different place because they don't have internet in the home. They don't have internet just walking around the street. They have to go to a Wi-Fi hotspot to connect. And it's really, it's fascinating. I you know, but I think as Cubans have more access to internet and have more, options to connect, they're asking for more hotspots. You know, they're given an inch and they want a mile, you know, and I think that's also why we think the policy needs to change. You know, we should be supporting the Cubans' right to keep demanding more. And we love that the Cubans are kind of asking for change. And we think American companies, you know, Google, Facebook, they all want to be part of that change. They all want to be part of your experience on the corner connecting to a hotspot. And so they're down there actively, you know, checking out the market. And then what we're doing at Engage Cuba is trying to, when they come back to the United States, saying, you got to go to your policymaker to make this a viable market for your products.
So in contrast to Cuba, where the government puts in hotspots and people use them for the very basics, connecting with relatives, things like that, in New York City, the government put in hotspots and everyone used them to watch porn. So that just shows the difference between when a country that has widespread internet access starts installing extra internet on the street, what people are going to use it for. But of course, there's always this issue of what can you do on the internet in Cuba? You've had a communist dictatorship for decades. It's not necessarily the full internet. So how does a Cuban's experience at one of these hotspots differ from our ostensibly open and free internet in the United States? Are there restrictions? Are there things they can't do? What does that look like?
So actually, the experience in terms of what you can access on the internet is not that different. You know, there are a few sites that are blocked, mostly dissident bloggers. But for the most part, you know, you can get online and read the Miami Herald or, you know, watch whatever YouTube videos you'd like. The more prohibitive aspect of the experience is the slow internet speed. So whereas we're used to pulling up videos and quickly changing between, you know, an article and Facebook or whatnot, that process is going to be much slower in Cuba.
So we've seen the Obama administration really make a big push. This is going to be a key part of his legacy, likely. But there's probably a gulf between what the president wants to see happen and what some Americans and maybe politicians in Florida, especially some Republicans, want to see happen. So Lydia, what is Obama's like progression here? I mean, we start with a little bit of a normalized relation. I mean, what else does he want to see happen when we talk about our work not being done in terms of normalizing relations?
Well, the Obama administration had taken some steps before the December 2014 policy announcement. And since then, both the Department of Commerce, and I focus on the Federal Communications Commission, so that's sort of what I've been looking at. But many agencies, State Department in the lead, have really been pushing for new, let's say, loosening of financial restrictions that would prohibit companies from being able to do business there and get paid there. And there have been just a number of steps that perhaps Michael or Addy can speak to a little bit more. But on the tech and telecom front, they really made an effort to promote the export and the sale of telecom equipment to Cuba. And part of that is because Huawei, a major international but a Chinese company that deals internationally, is kind of eating the U.S.'s lunch right now. They're the ones who are powering these Wi-Fi hotspots with their equipment, and they're doing all sorts of other deals with the Cuban government to set up more internet infrastructure. And as you can imagine, Cuba is our very close neighbor. There are a lot of American companies like AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, all the major wireless companies, and then everyone through their supply chain are interested in doing business with Cuba and competing with, you know, Huawei and some of their other big international competitors.
So why is China eating our lunch? I mean, you could think of many reasons. One might be that an authoritarian regime trusts an authoritarian regime more than, right? So if the Cuban government's going to be...
Why don't you hold off 2 weeks until we have President Trump and we can talk about authoritarian regime?
Please. I mean, some of us are still in the mourning phase that started like 6 months ago. But anyway, so, you know, maybe the Castro government is going to be more trusting of a regime that has censored its own population, that does have this kind of weird hybrid between capitalism and, you know. So
two things here. Like, you know, we haven't had a relationship with Cuba for 55 years. And so when, you know, we think about national security threats, like I think a really great example of this, not to go off track, is what less than a year ago, the United States military accidentally shipped a bomb to Cuba, a missile.
Whoops.
And yeah, ended up there. And, you know, thank God it came after December 17th when we normalized relations, because within weeks it was returned to the United States. You can imagine that not happening if we didn't have diplomatic relations.
Or they might have seen the shipping of a bomb as a little bit more of an aggressive act than, oh, whoopsies, we were trying to send you.
Well, it was like packaged up and delivered by like FedEx or something. It was really bizarre. But anyways, and so,
that's,
you know.
That's worrying in itself.
Yeah. Yes. No, there are many failures there. But, you know, it's the same argument for, you know, why they're going with China. They don't trust us. And surely they don't trust us after Alan Gross. You know, what was he carrying when he was in Cuba? Telecommunications equipment that he was giving to dissidents.
Can you just remind our listeners who Alan Gross is?
Yes. So Alan Gross was a USAID contractor who was imprisoned in Cuba for about 5 years. He was ultimately released as part of the December 17th normalization of relations, but he was arrested in Cuba for distributing telecom equipment, which, you know, when we don't have relations with a country and we specifically, you know, both sides ban telecom equipment imported from either country, big no-no, big breach of trust. So it's not really a surprise to me that we're not part of their telecommunications plan at the moment.
So there's a trust issue, but is it also a policy issue? Is it easier under the law for a Chinese company to operate in Cuba than an American company? And is there a change that we should make that would level the playing field so that AT&T can compete with Huawei on the merits, not on this geopolitical trust issue?
And that's what President Obama has done. He's made it possible so that it's a general license. Any telecom company in the United States can compete down there. But we always remind companies, you're facing U.S. regulatory problems, and then you're facing Cuba regulatory problems. And that's kind of the situation now. But Obama wants it to be on you know, incumbent on the Cubans to say no. We don't want the U.S. to be the problem.
But it requires an act of Congress for these U.S. companies to actually do more than just export telecom equipment, and that's just in the telecom sector. But tell us a little bit about what it would
certainty,
take.
They want certainty, right?
But even to actually say to build a backbone, an internet backbone network in Cuba would take an act of Congress, right?
Well, So you're thinking about what does it take to build telecom anywhere in the world? Financing. You know, you're going to have to figure out a way to pay for all the infrastructure. And financing is one of the biggest problems and impediments to U.S. companies doing business in Cuba right now. Most banks Have been accustomed to being sanctioned for doing any kind of business in Cuba. And just because President Obama now says banks are okay to do it, they're not going to invest a lot of money in changing their internal processes, knowing that a President Trump could come in and then file a sanction against them.
Yeah, it's not very certain. Lydia, you've covered tech and telecom in the United States. Cuba is so fascinating because we're really seeing a case study of a country that is almost a blank slate in many ways. I mean, for all the problems that the United States has in some rural areas with connectivity and whatever, we've had our progression from the telegraph to the telephone to broadband, et cetera, it's gone a certain way and we've studied it. What are you looking out for? What fascinates you the most about the fact that this is now going to be opening up, and what trends are you looking for? What patterns are you going to be trying to report on, maybe?
Well, when I speak with folks in the tech and telecom sectors, they tell me that this is a really exciting opportunity for them because this is a country with a population of about 11 million, an obvious desire to be connected to the world. And yet it's something called a green field. I mean, there's a little bit of infrastructure, but it's pretty old, it's decaying, and there is a lot of opportunity there. Some Cuba analysts have said that Cuba is sort of in this prime position to, if their leaders are bold and really interested in working with the U.S., leapfrogging from the 2G technology they have now, and they're sort of taking slow steps to upgrade to 3G, to going actually to 5G around the same time or slightly after we are. In the U.S., that target is 2020. Although some companies are saying, like Verizon are saying, we're going to roll stuff out that are 5G enabled by next year. So,
and just to put 5G into perspective, because we talked about 1G, you can make phone calls, 2G, you're looking at texting and maybe some email, 3G, a little bit more, 4G, we associate with HD streaming. 5G, I mean, what can you do with a 5G connection?
5G, all the applications that 5G will enable is still to be determined, but folks are talking about primarily it powering the Internet of Things, you know, connected devices. And we're talking billions of connected devices by 2020. That's what most analysts are predicting. So, you know, Cuba has a lot of sectors that are very important that could benefit from the Internet of Things, primarily agriculture, transportation. These are some of the areas that they've targeted for investment themselves. And that have also gotten a lot of U.S. interest, right, guys?
Yeah, and as we talk about the role of internet, especially regarding the development of Cuba, I think it's so important to underline that there needs to be a solid infrastructure of connectivity and internet for there to be an investment climate in Cuba, right? Even just taking the example of the few American companies that have gained a foothold in Cuba, like Starwood, you know, for them to operate their hotel at maximum efficiency, they're going to want to be able to connect with their folks down there. And if they're unable to do so, that's going to send a sour message to other companies that might be interested.
Given all the connectivity problems, there are some businesses that are really taking off in Cuba. One of them is Airbnb. And at a basic understanding, I'm thinking one of the reasons it's taking off is people already own property. So that's not a hurdle that you have to clear. Like, you have your home, you can rent it out. That's something that exists. You don't have to build something new. And also the fact that the hotel industry is very tightly regulated down there and very expensive. We've heard taxis are very expensive. Certain industries that you don't necessarily think of being so heavily regulated and expensive are in Cuba. So anything else on why Airbnb seems to be one of the companies that's really taking off in the short term in Cuba?
So the permission to have the concept of a bed and breakfast was actually introduced in the 90s after the Soviet Union collapsed and was one of Cuba's main trading partners, and the economy of Cuba contracted tremendously. So the Cuban government made a decision to open themselves up to tourism. And part of that decision was allowing Cuban citizens to open their homes for bed and breakfasts. So I think that pre-existing model was part of the success for Airbnb, because it's not like they had to introduce the concept from scratch.
And now you've got American tourists who are quite familiar with the platform. You've got European tourists, people who've used this all the time, and they're going to be very comfortable using it when they go to Cuba, maybe more comfortable than something that is more unknown, like staying in a hotel in Cuba.
Everybody, all your listeners right now are being like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. But then, wait, let's go back to the beginning of the podcast. Nobody has internet in their house.
Right.
So if you're an Airbnb you know, if you operate an Airbnb in Cuba, how are you possibly managing all the bookings? And this is where Airbnb really kind of added a little bit of element of genius in how they set up their operations. And I'll let Michael go a little more into that.
Yeah, I mean, there really are just a few Airbnb managers on the island that like go around and update the system, you know, like update the listings and gather the payments or distribute the payments and
things that are pretty much automated in other countries with a lot of internet. So the company provided some staff on the ground to help bridge the gap between your house and the public Wi-Fi hotspot.
Right. They just have some middlemen.
So in the country that was the birthplace of El Paquete, all of us are looking out to see what Cubans are going to be able to do with internet. I mean, if you have that entrepreneurial spirit, you come up with something as genius and as risky and dangerous as El Paquete. What are Cubans going to do with more internet access? And recently there was a competition. Can you tell me about this competition and some of the Cuban startups that have stood out to you among the pack?
So there was this competition hosted in Miami. Called 10 by 10K, and it selected a handful of entrepreneurs that have either had success to date or that they believe have the potential to really take off. So some of the winners that stood out are a woman named Indira. She created Isla Dentro, which is basically a guide of things to do in Cuba. She got a big shout out when President Obama went down and he had this forum on entrepreneurship. Another is this application called A La Mesa, which is basically Cuba's Open Table, and a beautiful app. And, you know, they just kind of recreated what had been established here in the U.S. as Open Table and created a version of Cuban restaurants. And then there's another called Conoce Cuba, which is like a Yelp for Cuba. So you see this pattern of successful applications or internet websites that were created in the U.S. and then are just kind of recreated, but with the Cuban market in mind.
And actually, I'd just like to add that in Cuba, they have a list of, I think it's over 200 officially authorized self-employment positions, and computer programmer is one of them.
Ah, excellent. So another good trend in terms of allowing people to use their skills. So we've got challenges on both sides of the sea, so to speak. We've got the American political system, which is not universal in its desire to normalize relations with Cuba. And then we've got the fact that Cuba is still a dictatorship and is still not maybe going to embrace this at the speed that we might like to see. But just quickly starting with the United States, what do you guys see as the biggest hurdles to normalize relations? We've already talked about the potential of a Republican president to come in and just undo everything, but let's assume that we have a President Clinton and the White House stays Democrat. What are the challenges still that will remain in the next Congress in 2017?
It's very simple. It's a few members of Congress from South Florida who have been in Congress for, you know, a total of, you know, 40 plus years combined. And that makes them very effective at influencing how other members that they've been around for a very long time vote. And not only that, they use their personal experience, their family experience to say, you know, you don't know anything about Cuba. I do. So, you know, don't even think about voting to normalize. And, you know, we find what's fascinating is that is at odds with many Cuban Americans now in Miami-Dade County.
Is this a generational thing? It's like the young Cubans don't have the animosity towards the Castro regime because they didn't know what life was like before it. So they're not comparing it to anything.
It's generational, but it's also, you know, the story of immigration, American immigration. Most Cubans who are coming to the United States these days than the last couple, you know, 15 to 20 years are economic refugees. They just want a better life where they can have internet and cars and, you know, operate like normal people, have a small business, and they can't necessarily do that in Cuba. It's becoming more possible in Cuba, but they're not political. I mean, they're not political refugees. And so when they come to Miami, they're saying, we hate the embargo. I mean, 97% of Cubans surveyed said they believe the embargo is an impediment to their economic freedom. So why are we supporting a U.S. policy that hurts the average Cuban
right,
that they don't support?
Yeah, so it's essentially political incentives in one state. I mean, whereas you've got the most prominent Cuban American politician is Marco Rubio. Where is he on this issue? He's running for re-election in the Senate because his presidential race fizzled out in spectacular fashion. So,
Well, that's the generational thing you're talking about. The people who have the money to invest in a Marco Rubio campaign or an Ileana Ross Layton or, you know, Mario Diaz-Balart, they're investing in. They're the older Cubans who have money and they're giving it to those candidates. And those candidates have made a career on from people who've supported them that love the embargo. And so there's no incentive for them to change.
Has the United States gained anything from the embargo at all?
No.
Yeah.
I literally can't think of a single thing that we've gained. I mean, you know, we're talking about Huawei, the Chinese, basically own the internet infrastructure in Cuba. The French just got the contract to remodel the entire airport. You know, you have Brazil who gives them all their, you know, poultry. You have Vietnam that gives them all their rice. The EU is a major top three trading partner with Cuba. We're like below five and we're 90 miles away. Why are Vietnam, China, and the EU major trading partners with our island neighbors?
Getting back to that trust issue, right? So we talked about the challenges here. What about in Cuba? I mean, yes, we can be optimistic about all the things that are happening. But Lydia, in your discussions with people in the tech sector, do they think that the normalized relations and the steady growth in internet access, is this going to lead to political reforms, to freedom in Cuba? Are they optimistic that the barriers are going to come down, or is it going to just be a lot slower than we'd like? I mean, what do you see as the future of the Cuban government and technology?
I'd say that folks are very much taking a wait-and-see approach. Part of that is political because President Raul Castro will be in office until 2018, and people don't know what the official government policy is going to be after that. It's very top-down, so what next moves ATEXA will take when they have a new president will be very much dictated by the president and his advisors and you know, right now, ATEXA is making a tidy profit on these $2 an hour Wi-Fi connections, and they may not see an incentive to necessarily open up that monopoly. If it does happen, people think that it may come in the form of public-private partnerships.
Where ATEXA agrees to partner with someone because they have something they don't have or something like that.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And if you look worldwide at developing countries that have really tried to stand up a modern internet infrastructure and connectivity for their population, there are a lot of different flavors that a PPP could take. So, you know, in 2018, 2019, that will be the time for people to really see what's going to happen next. But right now, it's very unclear.
To wrap up the show, are there any short-term in this Congress or maybe in the next efforts to get to some of those policy goals that Engage Cuba wants to see happen? Are there any bills floating around, votes, hearings that people could look out for?
Yes. So we are currently working on an agriculture financing amendment. Kind of one of the stranger things about U.S. policy is everybody can privately finance goods sold to Cuba, whether it's a, you know, telecommunications infrastructure. It's not saying that companies will do it, but they're allowed to at the moment under Obama regulations. The only people that aren't allowed to, who still have to take cash instead of financing, is the agriculture sector. And so Engage Cuba is working to push that amendment through. And we really see if that'll kind of break the flood of the embargo. We really see it as kind of a wall. And if we can reach a compromise with the Republican leadership to move that issue forward, we think next year, based on our vote counts that we have in both the House and the Senate, we think next year could be a prime opportunity to kind of get this thing done, to end the full trade and travel ban.
Well, this has been a great discussion. I've enjoyed having all of you on, and we'll certainly be following this issue because this is not the last we're going to see of the tech development in Cuba. This is just the beginning of what is probably going to be the most fascinating case study in telecom. So I thanks again. My guests have been Addie Bryant from Engage Cuba, Chief of Staff, Michael Mizell, Director of External Affairs at Engage Cuba, and Lydia Bayoud, Senior Tech and Telecom Reporter for Bloomberg BNA. Thank you all for joining. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Tech Freedom. Send us an email at media@techfreedom.org. Let us know what you think of the show. Feel free to pitch topics and guests. Find this podcast in the iTunes store, where you can please leave us a review, because we'll help others find the show. Thanks for listening.
Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.